Well, thanks, Nicholas. Good afternoon again. My name is Carolyn. I'm another lawyer here in Hamburg, just like Christian before. I'm just working for another firm. And I have a great panel here that Nicholas and his team put together for us. And maybe I just introduce you while you get something to drink. To my left, I have Christian. Christian is working with BlackRock and has been working with BlackRock for a number of years. Is that right?
7 years.
We have Niels. Niels is working with Haren Group, SRL, as well, representing more or less the owner's side on the investors panel. We have Konstantin of MBC Capital. I think he should be known as well to the group here in Hamburg. And we have John Wessel of Ollendorf Overseas Investments. And yes, this morning it was mentioned that this is going to be a red day, or that this was a red day. This is pink, just that everyone realizes, please. And we had last night at the speaker's reception at Watson Farley's, the question was raised, how long will the party in shipping go on? This morning someone mentioned it could be for another 10 years. The ship finance panel was rather hesitant on that, I would say. But John, you were cited a while ago, 3 weeks ago or so, to have said this is definitely not the right time to invest. So as we're talking about the investor's perspective, can you please enlighten us a little?
Yeah, I'm proud. I've never been cited before. But I think one thing needs to be, the message needs to be refined in that sense that we are classic asset investors. Asset appreciation is part of our investment thesis. And from that perspective, no, it's in my view not the right time to invest. I think from a risk return perspective, it is everything else than a good time to invest. I think the values of the tonnage is prohibitive. And on top of it, we currently see the market going down than anywhere else. That's true for containers, that's true for tankers, that's true for bulkers. So ultimately, we remain positive in the long run for the industry, but 2025 and maybe even 2026, we have a rather moderate outlook, which will be ultimately good for us because we basically sold most of our vessels so we can reinvest.
Okay, so if you're saying 25, 26, are you then looking at a time to invest in 27? So telling us that you would look, or you would expect a market downturn in 27?
Well, listen, I would be lying if I know what the market's going to look like in 27. So 25, we believe the market's going to not develop too positively across most of the segments.
Okay, but if it was said before, well, this morning, that a good investor is a realist who is, if I was not mistaken, buying from a pessimist and selling to an optimist.
Sounds
would you characterize
right.
yourself as a realist or rather pessimist?
Well, a realist, I guess.
Okay, thank you. Christian, you told me that you had been invested for quite a while into Gaslog.
Correct.
Yeah. An LNG-related mm-hmm. company, but that you just got rid of that investment a few weeks ago. So
we did.
What yeah. drove that decision? What was the background for that?
Well, first of all, thanks for the invite. And the opportunity to speak. So perhaps just to start with a bit of background to the fund and our strategy, because that would also explain the decision that we took in relation to Gaslog. So just briefly, I sit in a part of BlackRock that invests into the infrastructure space. So we invest into companies or assets in the broader infrastructure space, be that energy, transportation, logistics, and also digital infrastructure. And we don't invest in listed stocks. We invest in privately owned companies, privately owned businesses. And often we do that in joint venture together with corporates, families, essentially strategic partners. As part of our strategy, what we typically do is we take longer term views. We typically aim to hold our investments for up to 10 years, sometimes even a little bit longer. But we do need to exit. We're a closed-ended fund, so we do need to exit at a certain point in time. We can't hold our investments forever. Unlike families or corporates, we can't hold our investments forever. So in the case of the LNG market more broadly and gas more specifically, because the market had developed in such a favorable way over the last 2 to 3 years, we saw this as an opportunity to essentially accelerate our returns that we would have otherwise only earned over a longer period of time. So it is part of our strategy to exit. We have to exit. In most cases, we hold investments for a longer period of time and we earn more of our return through ongoing dividends. But in the case of Gaslock, there was an opportunity to crystallize our target returns earlier.
So would you share that view that now it's not the time to invest? Or would you just say, no, this was a special situation, we could accelerate returns, but we are still looking into investing today?
It all depends on your strategy and your investment horizon. So if you are an investor that invests at the low point, rises the cycle, and then exits, which is has been a very, very successful strategy, of course, in the world of shipping. That is, then probably doesn't make sense. If you are a very long-term investor,
yes. You said you were looking at 10 years.
Correct, exactly. So if you're a very long-term investor and you can take a through-the-cycle view, mm-hmm. And you believe in the specific case of LNG, in the long-term macro, and also the ability to leverage a platform such as Gaslock to do other things in the, let's call it the broader gas shipping space, and build value over time. This has the potential for being a great investor for the party and great investment for the party that we sold to. So it always goes back to this sort of investment philosophy point, and there are different types of investors.
This morning on the energy panel, there was a discussion about the eco-fuel value chain, basically, about terminals, about storages, about transport, about getting rid of certain emissions. And so would you think that eco-fuel value chain or this, let's say, green fuel value chain would be an investment target that is attractive to BlackRock, and rather since you're financing infrastructure, or your fund is financing infrastructure?
Yes, is the short answer. The sort of key features that we look for in our investments are visibility of cash flow. So I think the issue with a lot of the green infrastructure mm-hmm. that is being developed and designed at the moment is that the offtake contracts are not there yet. There is a lot of interest, but mm-hmm. to actually have signed offtake agreements, utilization agreements for the infrastructure, it's going to take a bit of time. So in order for a fund like our fund to be interested and to actually commit to investment, these contracts need to be there. There are other pockets of capital, perhaps not so much in the infrastructure space, but higher risk, higher return pools of capital that can take more of a development approach and can take development risk for us that is trickier. We typically tend to come in when the final investment decisions are being made and construction is about to be started and the large sort of capex requirements need to be funded. So yes, we're very interested in the value chain. We do think there certainly is a future for CO2, for ammonia, for methanol, etc. But it is still quite early for the type of investor that we are.
Okay, so we are back to the chicken and egg problem, because Niels, as an owner, would certainly always say, well, I'm not investing into ships that need a certain infrastructure if the infrastructure isn't there. I would assume. But Niels, if you look at the owner's perspective, and we just learned at the ship finance panel that these days, since owners are in a pretty nice situation to say, owners have sort of become investors as well. You've been looking at some greener vessels, I would say, the Orca class vessels Søren mentioned before as well. So what was driving your investment there? Was it the ESG factor? Was it the demand by clients, by customers? What was driving this?
Maybe one word more like in general, that when we take investments decisions on vessels, it's like two classes of decisions. One is an opportunistic deal, which might be even pretty short term, which follows the general perception, like, is it a good timing or is it a bad timing? So that's something. But this is not what you're asking about. This is not what the Orca class is about. The other way of looking at investments for us is to really see, and that's going far beyond the asset itself, far beyond the steel, because we are looking at the vessel as a tool to serve our commercial services, to serve our clients. So that kind of disconnects those decisions even a little bit from the actual market timing, because it's a long-term investment with a totally different purpose, and the purpose is to serve our clients' transportation needs. And that means that those decisions are much more driven by the actual customer need for transportation. It's kind of, in case of the Orca vessels, for example, they have been sort of reverse engineered from the current and expected customer needs. What does the vessel need to look like to be fit for those requirements now and in the next 30 years? Mm-hmm. So those decisions are totally driven by different aspects than the pure timing. Of course, timing plays a role, of course. You don't want to potentially get the highest point in time. But it's more a strategic decision for the customer service in context of fleet renewal, etc. When it comes to the green side of things, it's a similar approach, because today all potential future fuels are in the infancy, except LNG, if you make that part of that sort of fuel mix. And all of the other fuels are pretty young in their technology status, and also especially in the supply side. So to implement those aspects into those ships is in fact to sort of future-proof them and to be ready for what will come, and do that with a view on what is technologically wise possible and prudent to do today, and make sense from a pure investment point of view as well. Of course, the numbers have to make sense commercially. Those investment decisions need to make sense, but it's not kind of a pure green thing. It's about being future proof, and it's also about being ready for what we believe will come.
Mm-hmm. Konstantin, you mentioned a while ago you were looking at other asset classes. Now, yesterday, I think you announced that you are investing into hydrogen ready vessels. Is that correct?
Well, not really.
No. Not really. Okay. Then.
Some things get written and some things are true, but I'm happy to shed some light on this. No, we are looking, and maybe also to take a step back, we are looking at either opportunistic investments, similar to what John mentioned, or to more strategic ones. And strategic means structural growth markets which, not like container, dry bulk or tankers, are pretty mature, and you have an up and down volatility driven by the underlying macro trends, but rather markets that grow in general. And we have a strong view that the offshore wind service market is a structural growth market. For example, the same would apply for the LNG infrastructure or energy infrastructure market, or for the renewable energy market, which is a market where MPC Capital next to shipping is also invested. So I think that's the starting point in terms of our view on investment opportunities. And what we have done is we have contracted offshore survey and service vessels, rather smaller, so vessels that are not the ones that are generally acquired over the last couple of years by most of the players that have invested in the space. It's way smaller. I would say, a bit of a niche. We do believe that this is a sector that is extremely attractive because of the high flexibility and the structural growth of the market. And yes, they are, I mean, green, what is green? I mean, they are, I would say, they are able to run on green fuels from the outset and on hydrogen potentially once you carry out additional investments. Okay. So that's where we are. But again, to put it into the context, it's opportunistic investments on the one hand. And there, I think John made the point earlier in what is the right time. I personally think if you're opportunistic, you should actually act in any market environment. It depends how you manage and de-risk your residual value risk and maintain the upside. And the upside you can also maintain if you buy at a high price, if you have a good counterparty on the cash flow and can de-risk the investment. So I would not be as cautious on buying in this market as John has mentioned, but certainly I think it's a time where you have to be cautious in taking a decision, but you can still buy also opportunistically, in my view, in this market environment. On the structural growth path for everyone to decide what's a good market. We do believe bunker infrastructure, new fuels, as well as offshore wind is an attractive field.
Okay. John, if you hear that, you remain convinced that you would not invest now in any of these sectors, backing away a little bit from the pure shipping perspective.
I mean, these are completely different sectors to what we're looking at. This is not at all tonnage related. This is our background, this is our heritage, and this is what we know. I wouldn't disagree on these sectors, with the exception of offshore wind. But but nevertheless, I stick to my point. Nonetheless, I wouldn't contradict myself so easily, I think.
No, I just wanted to check whether you. I understand now that you limit this to your segments.
Okay, I mean, de-risking is a good point. I think risk return for us is important, and what we sometimes in these great times forget how risky our business actually is, and the return has to match that. And even with a de-risking, we still struggle to get an IRR at the current levels of above 15 or 20%, and then we don't do it.
Okay. If we look at what happened overnight, and if we look at what this may have as an effect on, well, pricing of fossil fuel, would any one of you sort of say, well, today is obviously a different day than it was yesterday, but today I may have a different perspective onto investing into the bunker fuel terminal market than I had 2 days ago?
I think it's too early. it's way too early to have a firm view on that. I'm saying that because, I mean, ultimately, the Trump administration during the campaign was not very specific on what exactly they're going to be doing on the oil and gas side.
Mm-hmm.
A few, sort of slogans, a number of sort of more high-level statements, but what that will actually translate to from a production perspective, from an export perspective, very early days. And then there's also the prospect of increasing trade friction. So putting out all of that together, I think it's very, very hard to have a crystal ball. We just have to see what's going to happen.
Konstantin, have you any?
No, I agree with that, and I think it's super difficult to foresee what that means and what is going to happen. And it's, in my view, too early to take a view there.
From an operator's perspective, from a manager's perspective, what's your view?
Well, the point I made earlier, when we take those investment decisions, they are very long term, and they usually, as we use the ships ourselves, they are usually for the lifespan of a ship. So if we have potentially maybe there's a delay in new fuels to be kind of supported broadly by this decision overnight, and just as a scenario, Does that really affect any decisions that are taken long term? And I would say no, because the direction to decarbonize shipping remains intact, independent of what's happening over the last next 4 years or so. It might affect some kind of very short-term decision-making, but in the long term, I think we do need to actually move very quickly, because if we look at the goals for 30, 40, and especially 50, we are already a little bit late overall. I mean, very late, in fact. And if we look at the order book, which is only like 50%, around 50% on dual fuel technology, this might kind of add to the problematic reaching of the goals, but I think overall it might lead to some delays, but not change our overall decision making.
Okay, thank you. If we look at the development towards more environmentally friendly fuels, about technology, we have been, or not probably not you and not me, but industry-wide, there has been quite a bit of moaning going on over the past, I don't know, decade, that there is not enough innovation that is actually driven by the shipping industry itself. There was a lack of collaboration, that there was a lack of investment, that there was some good ideas around, especially in the field of digitalization, collecting data, but that some of these never succeeded due to lack of capital. Now, if at least three of these gentlemen are looking rather at investments, what has kept you, as far as I know, but maybe I'm just not aware of it, from sort of going forward with something like, let's call it a venture capital, and invest in any of these ideas? Have you never been approached? Have you never been asked for, John?
Yes, we have been approached multiple times, but I don't want to go into definitions, but venture capital for me is a group of investors looking for emerging opportunities in large markets. Shipping is neither a large market, nor are we a group of investors, and we are not particularly known to share secrets with each other. So
that's part of the problem.
The problem is it's too small. The market is too small, and I simply think shipping is not a good place for venture capital. What there is development by small companies, by big companies who take views. For example, we do invest a lot in services. We believe one of the most pressing problems are actually the people, but that's nothing to do now with the things you discussed. So I don't think it's I think the shipping market has to wait from developments outside the shipping industry, which are being carried into the shipping industry and then being taken forward from there. In terms of VC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Constantine?
We have also been approached. We have invested into a synthetic fuel startup, but that is more linked to also getting some exposure. Because if you don't invest, you don't get exposure, then you rather, you know, talk about it on parties or on panels without really having a clue. And that's always an issue in my view. But to have a clear venture capital mandate in shipping, I mean, I would say we are not experts in that. I don't see a direct benefit to our business today. And I think a lot of things have not kind of materialized or kind of grown in the way it possibly should have in terms of innovation, etc. But I think it's such a scattered industry. There is innovation. Look at the Mercer McKinney Center of Zero Carbon. Look at, you know, some other centers. But you need big sponsors to provide capital. I don't see that necessarily as a great investment sector for someone to like us to invest in any event. But it's probably for others. I think it's for bigger institutions to create platforms that allow collaboration. And we are an active member. We have actually seconded a person to the Mercer McKinney Center. I think that is where I see benefit for industry players like us or also for investors. But I think everything else is at least not for us. There might be other views, but not for us.
As a investment firm, basically, BlackRock
yes.
would probably rather be a sponsor of new ideas and innovation in shipping?
Oh, look, I don't have too much to add to what John and Constantine said. I mean, ultimately, our mandate is very much to invest in, you know, larger companies with the ability to generate near-term cash flows. So if someone comes to us with a venture capital idea, they know very quickly that they're knocking on the wrong door. Okay. Having said that, you know, yes, BlackRock as an institution more broadly is always interested in finding ways to play a role in the global debate. But we don't necessarily have, you know, the pools of capital available to invest, to make VC investments. That's a slightly different game. Mm-hmm.
But John, you mentioned that you're investing into people. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, many shipping companies basically do that. I mean, that's basically part of what we do. There are obviously our engineers, our superintendents. The average age is now, I think, at I don't know, above 50. And I think there's a growing concern that there's a lack of qualified technicians on board of our vessels, ultimately implicating the security of our vessels and the security of the industry. So I think it's a good idea to start early there, whatever it may be. For us, it was just looking more on the technical side and building a couple of new companies for that. But that's what every shipping company needs to do.
Okay. No, because you mentioned that before that. That's why I thought. Okay.
Karin?
Yeah.
Can I make one statement?
Of course. Or what,
because I, for some reason, I was just skipped
Sorry.
On this innovation point. And it tells me that maybe we haven't been vocal enough about it. So just two statements here, please. One is, I think to support innovation is not necessarily a VC-only approach. Yeah. For example, we do not do that normally. Mm-hmm. But what do we do is that we offer... We do a lot of trials with startups, with young companies that have a product or an idea that we feel will contribute to our success. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a win-win trial. It doesn't always mean that we continue afterwards, but it's really a way to enhance those ideas or kind of to give them a platform to try. So we do that kind of with a number of young companies. So that's a way to contribute to innovation as well, to give it a real life platform and a real mm-hmm. life testing. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, and that's probably even kind of stronger now connected also to the Orca vessels we mentioned earlier, that we have a fairly strong engineering team and design team. And then Sarah mentioned that like around 80 people globally in this space, and they are very, very innovative. And they have designed those ships not only in terms of the perfect hull shape, etc., but also by kind of taking a very an engineer's paradise approach to really develop those ships. And then we have to kind of scale down on some of those ideas because they commercially didn't kind of fit into the project. But it really led to a vessel that contains a lot of innovation and innovative aspects and approaches from the fuel side all the way to the electricity battery packs to all different sorts of further items that go into the ESG side on the S, for example, also for the crew. So I would say that there's a lot of ways to approach innovation very actively, very pragmatically, and in a really real life sort of approach to make it turn it into an immediate benefit also. So there's other ways beyond the VC approach. That's my point of that.
Yeah, no, that's good to hear because that's definitely something that has to happen. If we now just change the topic, and if we're talking on the investor's perspective on shipping here, of course, John mentioned before he doesn't have the crystal ball, so he doesn't know what happens in 27. But as we all know, shipping is cyclical, and we have had between 2010 and 2018, we had a number of PE funds and other funds coming across the ocean and investing in German shipping, driving partly consolidation. Others just burned their fingers and left again. And probably the German shipping market was somewhat peculiar, at least from their point of view. What would be your expectation? Would you think that the German shipping market would be ready for another round of opportunity? Well, investment funds looking for opportunities here. If we assume 27, 28, whenever John's crystal ball and the downturn.
Don't blame me.
No, I'm not blaming you. No, but would you think that the situation has changed after the experience of the last crisis, that the German shipping market would be ready for other investors? John, maybe you start, yeah?
I think I'm the wrong one to answer. We have a perfect answer sitting next to me. And there is, in terms of professionalism, in terms of governance, I think the Hamburg shipping community has narrowed down, but also professionalized. And I think I don't think it's going to be exactly the same approach of investors coming back to Hamburg, but I think Hamburg is back on the map in terms of a credible shipping's investor community.
Yeah, but if we hear like we heard on the panel on ship finance, sort of sort your cards while everyone is in a good mood. Yeah. So that's a question now. Do you think that the shipping industry should or is ready for third party investors, or aren't they? As far as you can see that. I'm talking about internal governance questions.
I'm sure there is. I mean, you have seen in Norway that there has been quite an active KS market, also from German, driven by German owners. And I think that speaks for itself. These are not KG investors. These are sophisticated investors who are behind that, who are taking this seriously, and I think that's a good sign, and that's a sign that there is a market for that.
Okay,
and I would argue, you know, back in the days, the reason for capital to coming to Germany was to basically buy cheap and basically buy someone out, either a bank or an owner who's under distress. That has changed. I mean, the ones that are still around, to put it that way, have solid balance sheets, and now it's more a partnership approach. So I really think the German market is ready. It's way different. You cannot compare the times, in my view. And that is certainly so. Balance sheet status and also ownership structure, right? It's not highly levered structures anymore. Everyone, also the owners, have solid balance sheets. So I think it's simply a different environment. And to John's point, I think things have become a bit more professional in terms of governance, in terms of understanding, you know, that fees have to be earned and are not just there because they are. And an alignment of interest is not just, is also aligning if you feel pain and not just having your ship ordered. So I think the whole framework has changed in a way and the situation. But I would say the German market is open. I mean, we are, as MPC Capital, we have a pure co-investment approach, right? I mean, we're always co-investing alongside institutional capital. So we usually invest between 0 and maybe up to 20% of the equity. So we have to partner with third-party capital. And hence, you have to play according to the rules. And some people understand the rules, are willing to also leave a bit more on the table for others, maybe on the fee side, and then you have a common ground. And I think that's the way in a capital intensive business like shipping, unless you have a super strong balance sheet or have a fund with billions of dollars in capital, that's the way you have to operate, in my view. And that's the way at least we operate.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe just to answer the question with a slightly different hat on, so not specific to Germany, but sort of more broadly, interest of institutional investors in the marine space and the shipping space has been on the rise. If I look at what some of our sort of competitors have done, the likes of the KKRs of this world, the Morgan Stanleys of this world, the Stone Peaks of this world, they're all large institutional investors have invested in the marine space. I would, however, say that what their investments have had in common is a number of sort of features, you know, good contracts with, you know, longer durations, good off-takers, good clients, good charterers. The reputation of the management team and the partners need to be high. And then importantly, crucially, visibility over being able to exit. And that narrows down the segments quite significantly. Unfortunately, in today's world, it is much harder to build conviction that you'll be able to exit a crude oil-linked investment, for example. It can be a fantastic investment whilst you're holding it, but in terms of creating competitive tension, in terms of creating broad investor interest at the time of your exit, that's going to be challenging. So if you put all of these things together, it is not easy to create sort of a package that is of interest to, you know, sort of larger institutional capital, but it is certainly possible, right? So I think those are sort of some of the features that, you know, will attract more and more capital. And that is not a play on cycles. That is more a play on backing the right team, having the right contracts in place, and being able to exit it at a certain point in time.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're running out of time in a way, so I need of each one of you, I need the crystal ball. I'm sorry. But it's the investor's perspective, and the perspective is the look into the future as well. So what do you think will be the major challenges for the shipping industry in the next, let's say, 18 months? Maybe Niels, you start.
18 months.
Short term.
Yeah.
Probably you don't even need the crystal ball.
Well, 18 months is, from my point of view, very, very hard to predict, because it depends, or it will be driven by more hard to predict small black swans kind of into the other direction as they came from, like the Houthis. Will there be a change on the Red Sea trades? I don't know. Will this election of last night have any impact? I don't know, but I think it's these sorts of developments that will drive the next 18 months. It will be potentially less the big strategic developments, as we mentioned earlier, on the different fuel types. It will be a little bit less on the general cyclicality of the market. I think the next 18 months will potentially be driven in the ups and downs by those shorter term impacts and maybe new black swans that we haven't in mind yet. So I don't know the direction actually, but as we are already pretty high in most markets, the potentially most likely direction might be downwards in at least some of those markets.
John, what is your?
I would assume that tariffs will play an important role. If it's going to be negative or actually stimulating will be a question of individual ship types and classes, but we believe there will be a significant impact.
Mm-hmm. Constantine?
I think the geopolitical side, because it's to the point of Neil, difficult to predict, but we have so many geopolitical challenges at the moment that severely affect the shipping market. And I think there's more to come, actually. So there's more disruption. What it will be, I don't know. I think it's the uncertainty in connection with the geopolitical risks that might surface, and also the behavior of the US, for example, post election. I mean, how will that affect Europe? How will that affect the relation to China? What will happen in the Ukraine? I think there are so many geopolitical questions that will significantly affect shipping from an operational standpoint, but certainly also from an investment and certainty standpoint.
Question.
A lot of good points have been mentioned. Maybe one to add is quite full order books in a number of segments. How's that going to really play out over the next 18 months in conjunction with markets having been quite high in a number of segments for the last few years? How bad is the potential crash going to be with an 18-month perspective? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. It's not nice to close on a potential crash, though. Anyway, it has been an interesting panel. Thank you all, and thanks for listening to us.